The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. Hey, my name is Brian. My wife and I attend Summit in Malden. It's been my pleasure from time to time to be able to open up the Word for our communities, and this morning it's my delight to be here at Terry's invitation. As I was thinking about the passage this morning, actually my thoughts turned to a friend of mine who climbs mountains. Actually, he climbs glaciers. He climbs sheer cliffs. He grew up in Alaska, and he does this for fun, right? He spends days climbing up sheer glacier faces. He says he's never going to climb Kilimanjaro because it's well too climbed. He looks for more challenging climbs than that. And he doesn't follow trails. He makes his own way. And he was talking with me about how sometimes he takes others and he has to give them advice, instructions as to how they're supposed to climb. And one of the things he has to tell them is that when you're climbing a sheer face and you're finding your footholds and your handholds, as you're going up the face of the rock or the face of the glacier, one of the things you need to do is you actually need to push away from the face. And I think that's like counterintuitive. That doesn't make sense to me. If I'm on a sheer wall trying to climb up, I'm going to try to hug the face of the wall as closely as I can. He said that's really dangerous. Because when you do that, you don't get enough tension between your fingers and the wall and your fingers and your feet and the wall or the ice, and you're more likely to slip. You actually have to get a grip and kind of push away a little bit. And I go, well, that's why I'm never going to go climbing with you, because that just doesn't make sense. But he does it successfully, and he takes people with him. And it is so, seems so foolish, so ridiculous, so very counterintuitive. But if you don't listen to what my friend says, if you were climbing, you would be actually in danger. You'd be at risk if you don't actually do the thing that seems so counterintuitive. And that idea of a counterintuitive, a set of instructions that initially sounds foolish or doesn't seem to make sense to me, I think that's how I feel as I read through Peter. Peter's instructions, his counsel to followers of Jesus, is all about how to live with Jesus in the midst of trials, in the midst of trouble, in the midst of tribulation, in the stuff that strikes us and comes into our lives. And his advice, as I've been listening to what Peter has to say, sometimes seems foolish. It's very counterintuitive. It seems almost ridiculous. Why? Because my response in the face of trouble and struggle and trials is typically shock, is disappointment. It's more about griping and complaining. It is about discouragement and trying to figure it out and raising questions about what God is doing. But Peter's advice is incredibly different. It's so, in a sense, very counterintuitive. As if you've been here and we've been walking through Peter, you've heard a lot of these things that Peter's said, some incredibly different kind of advice. He's been saying things like to rejoice and to consider it joy and to lean in. And he's been weaving his thoughts together for us about how we're supposed to live in the midst of trouble, in the midst of difficulty. And it is not the way that I would typically do it. He's been weaving these thoughts together, and this morning we're actually coming to a passage that where he provides some summary, pulls some of those threads together, and again reminds me of what he said that's familiar because I've been hearing it, but what he said that shocks me because it's not the way that I would typically live in the midst of difficulty and trials. So I'd like to pray, even though Doug prayed. I'm going to pray and ask the Lord to give us ears to hear and a fresh appreciation, eyes that are open, so that what strikes me as so foolish and ridiculous in the face of trials and trouble, that the Lord might in fact open our hearts to hear from Peter through the inspiration of the Spirit again. So let me pray. I want, Lord, to admit right from the start that the things I've been reading in Peter's first epistle don't immediately make sense to me. They are not the things that first rise in my heart and my mind when I'm facing difficulties. But because of Peter's long relationship with you, because of Peter's understanding of the gospel, because you moved by your Spirit in Peter to write these words, because you blessed Peter's ministry as he proclaimed truth, these words are words I need to hear. These words are words I need to embrace and live into. I know this morning, as I open my mouth, my words are not going to bring about life change in the lives of these friends here gathered this morning. But your word, inspired, comes through Peter. That word, that could change us. That could awaken us to some fresh understanding of how well we could live in the midst of trials and trouble. Would you please do something in us through this word for our good and for the spread of your glory? Work in such a way that these, my friends, would hear through my words, your word, that they would not be caught up with the things I say, but they would be entirely caught up with the things that you say. And because of that, there would come real change, life change for us all, for our good and for your glory, I pray. Amen. Now keep in mind, Peter's not a masochist. What I mean by that is he doesn't like trouble for the sake of trouble. He doesn't suffer because he enjoys the pain of it. We've already heard some of that. If you've been with us any length of time, we've been going through Peter for a long while. Let me just remind you of a couple of things that Peter said in the first chapter of this letter. He says he's writing to those who have come into relationship with God through Jesus. That is, they have a personal relationship with God through Jesus. And he says that those are kept by God's power, being guarded through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this, you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you've not seen him, you love him. Though you do not see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. He says, it might be necessary for you to suffer. It might be necessary for you to suffer. Because, he says, the suffering results in the proven genuineness of your faith. It's not that suffering makes you something that you're not, but the suffering gives an opportunity to put on display your real dependence and trust in Jesus, and the result of that is rejoicing. So he talks about trials and faith and suffering and rejoicing there in chapter 1. Chapter 2, verses 19 and following, he writes and says, "For this is a gracious thing, mindful of God, when one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it to you if when you sin and you are beaten for it, you endure? But when you do good and suffer for it and you endure, this is gracious in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his footsteps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did make no threat, but he continued entrusting himself to the one who judges righteously." Do you hear what Peter is saying? Peter is saying, not only have you been called to grow in this faith, but you've also been called because of Jesus to share in his life. You have a purpose. Part of your purpose is to grow up to look like Jesus. And seeing as Jesus suffered, sharing his life will in fact include suffering in some kind. He says that we, those who are followers of Jesus, have been called for that purpose, not only to grow in faith, but in fact to grow up to look like Jesus. And then in chapter 3, a few weeks ago we lived here, chapter 3, verses 13 and following, Peter writes and says, Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you'll be blessed. Have no fear of them, those that oppress you, those that do trouble to you, nor be troubled in heart, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ Jesus may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. So, for Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. So we're being brought to God, brought into this life. We get to grow up in faith, we get to grow into this life of Jesus, and we are being brought into intimate relationship with the living God, and that might include suffering. That's, again, what Peter says here. It might be his will, and so in the midst of that suffering, he says we need to be ready to explain why we have hope, why we live differently. That's what Peter is talking about, how to live well in the midst of suffering while we're doing good. And it includes things like rejoicing. And I go, that's counterintuitive. I tend not to rejoice when things are not going well. And now the text this morning comes in chapter 4, verses 12 through 12 and following. And I'm going to read again from 1 Peter chapter 4. A side note, if you have a copy of the scriptures, you should be opening to this book. If you don't have a copy of the scriptures, you should be bringing this book. I noticed many of you come in with coffee this morning. You don't think you can get through a church service without a cup of coffee. I want to suggest you should not get through a church service without one of these in your hand as well. Coffee in one hand, scripture in the other hand, the coffee you need to stay awake, the book you need for life. My words are not inspired. Terry's words are not inspired. Jason's words are not inspired. Good teachers, yes. These are the words that will change you. I know you think the coffee changes you, and it does help, but these are the words that change you. Bring one of these with you when you come. So, 1 Peter chapter 4, I'm going to start in verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice! Rejoice! Insofar as you share Christ's suffering, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the spirit of glory in God rests upon you. But none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name, for it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Now here, a few verses, some summary thoughts. Peter is drawing his letter to a close. Chapter 5, he offers some practical insight about elders and leaders, and that will come in the weeks to come, but he is drawing these thoughts about suffering well while doing good to a close here in these verses. Mentioned a lot already of these things, but there are a few things to recap. Before we get there, though, I want to talk just a little bit about suffering, because as I've been reading through Peter and looking back over Peter, I want to think about what does Peter mean about trials, trouble, tribulation, suffering. Now, some in Peter's audience were facing real persecution. Their lives were being threatened because of their stand for Christ. But that is not everything that is included in Peter's language about trials or trouble or suffering. All the way back in chapter 1, the text I read already, he talks about facing various trials. That means a whole variety. There's not just one kind of suffering. There's a variety of sufferings. And in chapter 2, he says that we need to keep, if you're walking with Christ, you need to keep your behavior excellent as you're carrying on your life, even if people are slandering you. Well, that's not necessarily persecution. Your life might not be threatened. It might simply be people making fun of you because of the way that you choose to live. They might diss you because of the choices that you make. In chapter 2, verse 13, he talks about governing authorities. And certainly the governing authorities might in fact be the agents of the persecution, but they also still might just be dumb. Sometimes governing authorities just make bad choices and you choose to live differently than that, and it might get you in trouble, not necessarily persecution, life-threatening kind of stuff. But then in chapter 2, verse 18, he talks about masters and servants. He says, sometimes the master doesn't do the right thing. Hey, we live in worlds at times when those we work with or work for might not, in fact, value the things that we value, and it might not mean that your life is threatened in a persecutory way, but there might be suffering of some kind, some trial. He says that we need to keep our behavior good. We need to do well, even in the face of suffering. Suffering might include everything from sickness to having your head cut off for Christ. And most of us are not at that far end of the spectrum, but we face all kinds of suffering. It may include persecution, but in 1 Peter, the focus is on living out what is right as a child of God who shares in Jesus' life, even when you're treated poorly. This is Peter's language of suffering, that you're living out what is right as a child of God who's sharing in Jesus' life, even when things are not going the way that you think they should go. And that might mean that suffering would include things at work, where everyone at work, they they come to do an 8 hours worth of work, but they only do 7 hours of work, and they spend their time hunting and looking for stuff on their computer at work when the boss isn't looking, and they invite you to do the same, and you have a little more integrity than that, and you don't want to do that, and they start to diss you, and there's trouble there, and they take stuff from the office home. They don't pay me enough here, so I'm going to, and they want you to do the same, and you decide not to, and that gets you ostracized, and you're trying to live right as a child of God who's sharing in Jesus' life in the midst of a world that might not be going in that direction, and the results in some kind of suffering, some kind of difficulty. You get some kind of pushback. You don't get the raise because you don't play the game. There's some kind of suffering there. Maybe it happens at home. There's a kind of suffering that's there. Jesus says this remarkable thing. He says that if we love those who love us, then we're not living any different than pagans. He says if we give to those whom we expect to receive in kind, then we're not living differently than the sinners. That might mean that there will be times in family life, in relationship, that you're seeking to love like Christ loves. You're seeking to serve like Christ serves your spouse or your children or your parents or your family, and no one's returning the favor. No one's paying you back. No one's responding in kind. There is a kind of suffering that exists there. You're trying to live well, and no one is acknowledging it. You're not being lauded. You're not getting any return on your investment of affection. How will you live in the midst of that kind of suffering? It's really easy to throw up your hands and go, I'm done with this. This is not what I signed up for. And yet it is. You're called to suffer by doing well in the midst of difficulty. That's what Peter is talking about. It might be at church. Wait, suffering in church? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there might be suffering even at church. You serve others, and no one notices. Comes to the end of the year, and you don't get a trophy for being the greatest servant in the church. No one seems to care. You give your life away. You invest deeply in the lives of others, and not only is it not appreciated, sometimes you get rebuffed. Sometimes you get dismissed. Oh, you're just doing that for all the wrong reasons. No, I'm not. You're trying to really live out Christ's life, and it's not being ignored. There's suffering that comes there. There's all kinds of suffering, various kinds of trial, different kinds of trouble when you're trying under grace and by the Spirit and out of the gospel, doing what is right. So how are you supposed to respond in the face of suffering? Did you hear what Peter says? He's summing up. First thing, verse 12, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you. First thing is, do not be surprised as though some strange thing were happening. I think I get surprised a lot because I have this mistaken notion that I think if I live well, then I'll get less trouble. I think that my personal goodness guarantees goodness in return. Peter goes, don't be surprised at the fiery trial. When the suffering comes, don't be surprised when it comes upon you to test you as though some strange thing were happening. Friends, we are called to share in Jesus' very own life. He lived perfect, and he didn't get treated well. Do you understand? He did all the good that could be done, and he didn't get treated well. And we're shocked. Peter says, don't be surprised if you're sharing in Jesus' life and the one who lived so very well did not get treated well. Why are we shocked when we try to live Christ's life? We act as if suffering is somehow foreign to our lives. And you hear it in little ways. People will say things like, can you believe what they're doing to me? Yeah, I can believe it, because it says you're going to suffer. No, it's to me. I was only doing good. Can you believe what they were doing to me? How could they do that kind of thing to me? You sound shocked. You sound surprised. You're acting as if the goodness that you are living guarantees goodness in return. And I would simply say, well, look at Jesus, and then Stephen, and Peter, and James. And if you know that your faith, your dependence on Jesus is a growing thing, if you know that you are called to share in Jesus' countercultural life, if you know that you've been brought into life with God and that that might mean you're going to swim against the flow, if in fact you realize that you're called to live well regardless of the circumstances, that you are being built into a spiritual house in which God is going to put himself on display, all those things that Peter's been saying. If you know all of that, then you should not be surprised when you suffer. If you're reading a story, if the ending is a total shock to you, you've either misread the story or it's a really horrible author. Right? If you turn the last page and you go, no way! That's not how I thought the story was supposed to end. Either you've misread the story or the author didn't write it out very well. But we, facing suffering, go, no way! Life is not supposed to play out this way. I'm going to suggest one of two things. Either you're saying that God is a horrible author, which he's not, or you're suggesting you don't understand what the story's about. Right? The longer you walk with the Lord, the better your life should get, right? The older you are in the Lord, the bigger your house should be, the nicer your car should be, the more welcoming people should be towards you, that your life should become more and more and more comfortable. That's not the story. But I act like it is, and so I'm shocked when suffering happens. That's the first thing Peter says. Do not be surprised. Stop being shocked. But then he goes on to say, but rejoice, verse 13, but rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. So the second thing, first, do not be shocked when you encounter suffering. Second thing, but do keep on rejoicing. Now he talks about rejoicing now and rejoicing later. I was trying to think about that. When my kids were younger, we would take them on vacations. Summer break, we're going to go to Disney World in Florida. I can remember the trip to Disney World in Florida. Or we went to another amusement park, or we would go to the beach. And when you get the kids in the car, you know what? They're already rejoicing. We're not even there. They're already rejoicing. So there is a ongoing rejoicing, and yet a future rejoicing. So he talks about here, Peter says, rejoice insofar as you share the sufferings, so that you may also rejoice when the story comes to its culminating end and Christ returns. Brothers and sisters, we are not supposed to push off all the rejoicing until Christ's return. You're supposed to be rejoicing now, because you're participating in his life now. That's what Peter is saying. You know when you do rejoice, right? You know when joy bubbles up. Joy is experienced, joy is tasted, when in fact we have that which we want most. We only rejoice when we have or are getting what we long for most. The children at Christmas. It's Christmas and the presents are there under the tree and you're going to distribute the gifts to them and you give the kids the present that came from grandma, socks. The kids respond, thank you, grandma, for the socks. That's joy, right? They received a gift. It's joy, right? No, that's not what joy is. And then they get their favoritest, most specialist, been on the Christmas list since April, gift that's been under the tree. And they tear it open, and what do you experience? What do they experience? Joy. Joy is what you feel when, in fact, you are experiencing what you want most. So Peter says, in the midst of your trials, you should rejoice. Why? Because you're sharing in Christ's life. What do you want most? What do you really want? A year from now, would you rather be more comfortable or more like Christ? More comfortable? I opt for that. So in the midst of suffering, I have no joy. But if what I really want is to be more like Christ, then if trials, if suffering puts Christ's life on display, if suffering trials enables my faith and dependence in him to grow, if you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed. That's the enviable life. That's what the word blessed means. That's the enviable life because God's presence rests on you in the midst of your suffering. If that's what you really want, then in the midst of suffering, you could actually have joy. So if it's true that your trials make evident the realness of your faith, if it's true that your suffering is a participation with Jesus in his suffering, if it's true that the troubles that we go through give us an opportunity to say with our lives that God is the thing we value most. In the midst of our sufferings, we rejoice if what we want most is God to be put on display and to share more in the life of Jesus. I fear that sometimes our unwillingness, our inability, our lack of taste of joy in the midst of trials testifies by our living. Jesus is good, but something would be gooder. Jesus is okay. It's nice to have him. But it's not what I really want, because what I really want is the thing that would really give me joy, and if I really had that, whatever that is. But I live as if some other life would be better than sharing in Jesus' life. I mean, think about this for a minute. You get to share in life with Jesus. You get to be built into a house where God is going to put himself on display in glory. You get to be transformed and changed to grow up to look like the only Son of God. And in that, as that's going on, God's very presence rests on you in the midst of your suffering. What could be better than that? Well, a little better job. Kids that honored me a bit. I mean, we have a whole list of things that we think would be better than that. And as a result, in the midst of our suffering, we don't think it's really true that God is doing these things, and as a result, we don't rejoice. I tend to think that my comfort, my being valued, my being lauded, my plans playing out would in fact be better. I wait for something else, something more, for joy to come, because I don't understand the reality of what God is doing, that Peter's been laying out for us. So, do not be surprised upon encountering these fiery trials, the suffering that comes. And do keep on rejoicing, because you understand the reality of what God is doing in the midst of your suffering. And then he says, verse 15, but let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. So the next thing is, so don't be ashamed, but glorify God. Don't be ashamed, but glorify God. That's the blessed life. That's the enviable life. God is doing something when suffering comes because of Christ. The Spirit of God, the Spirit of glory rests on you. His presence is there. His manifest presence can be known in the midst. So there is no need to explain the ununderstandable suffering. I'm going through hard times. Don't be like Job's counselors who are wrong. Job, the only reason why you're suffering is because you've sinned, because suffering is always attached to sin. That's not true. Read the book of Job. It's a long book. Read the book of Job. At the end, God speaks to Job and says, actually, he speaks to Job's counselors and says to the counselors, you didn't speak well of me like Job did. The counselor said, all suffering is attached to your screwing up. Job goes, I don't think that. God says that's not the case. The suffering that Job is going through is not because Job is sinning. God is putting something on display in the book of Job. God is putting something on display in the life of Job. All suffering is not the result of screwing up, of sin in your life. God is working things for his glory. He's telling a story that might include suffering in your life. And if you don't fully understand, I don't understand why this suffering comes. I don't understand why this is happening. Peter says, don't be ashamed. You don't have to be embarrassed about that there's suffering, but glorify God. God is doing something, so in the midst of my suffering, I could glorify God. Now, a side note. Sometimes, friends, I don't know you personally, sometimes you mess up. And you suffer because you messed up. I mean, there are times when that is the case. Did you notice what he says? It's really interesting in the midst of all of this that he mentions, but let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Why does he put that in the midst of living well? I think it's a little, shall we say, hyperbole, overstatement for the point of emphasis. Jesus, in speaking about anger, none of you ever have a problem with anger, but there are sometimes some people, even some Christians might struggle with anger. And Jesus says that you've heard it say you're not supposed to murder, kill, but he says if you're angry, that's the same disease. we just manage it better. I want to kill somebody, but I don't really kill them. Only in my mind do I do that. Only in my relationship do I sever them. But so Jesus talks about murder and anger. James says the same thing in James chapter 4. He talks about anger and murder all being the same thing. I think Peter here is suggesting, now you shouldn't suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or literally a busybody. So why does he mention this? Well, friends, when you are in the midst of suffering and you are not rejoicing, and you are not looking to God, and you aren't making sense of it well in biblical ways, then what do you tend to do? You want to get out of the suffering. How do you try to get out of the suffering? You take things into your own hands, which means the person who is in fact the one causing you to suffer, what do you want to do? Bless them, right? Do good to them, right? No, you want them gone. Don't suffer as a murderer. You're not getting what you think you deserve. What do? You work to take it. Don't be a thief. Someone does wrong to you. Some wrong thing happens to you. What if you take things in your own hand? Do you try to do? I'm going to give them as good as they give me, right? You end up being an evildoer or just messing with people's stuff. So tucked in right here, I think when he says, don't be ashamed about the suffering. Now, don't suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a busybody. Just don't take things into your own hand and try to make the end the way you want it to in your own strength or power. But don't be ashamed by the suffering. But in the midst of it, glorify God. That is, declare him, cheer him on, that God is doing something here that I may not understand. He is the captain of the winning team, and in fact, by his doing, I am on his team, and we're going to come out of this in such a way that Jesus will be seen in my life, and my faith will grow, and my dependence on him will grow, and he will be glorified, and this is good, and I can cheer him on. He does say then in verses 17 and 18 a puzzling thing to me. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God, and if it begins with us, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinners? What is Peter saying there? When he talks about judgment beginning with the house of God, I don't think you should be thinking about this as a condemning judgment. Earlier on in this letter, Peter makes reference to Jesus and says that Jesus entrusted himself to the one who judges righteously. Same language, judges. So Peter's saying here that judgment starts with the house of God, meaning if Jesus entrusted himself to the one who judges righteously, the one who assesses everything rightly, the one who sees everything rightly, then here Peter is saying that God's assessment, God's evaluation, God's assessment of what's right begins with us. Who should be living well? You. Who should be living for the glory of God? You. Who should be living as if grace were true and the gospel changed everything? You. Who should be living as if life shared with Jesus is the most valuable thing? You. So he says that's where the assessment's going to begin. The assessment's going to begin with, are you living into what you say is true? Is it evident in the way that you are living? Are you surprised when you suffer? Do you stop rejoicing? Are you ashamed and embarrassed? Do you stop glorifying God? Peter says, wait, the assessment begins with you. Brothers and sisters, we sang songs this morning about how good and faithful God was, how he is our secure provider, he's our safety, he's our refuge. And then in the midst of suffering, we act shocked, we don't rejoice, we manipulate and connive, we don't lean in well, we're embarrassed and ashamed, we don't glorify God. Peter goes, hey, the assessment starts here. You say all that's true. Are you living there? And then closes with verse 19. Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. There it is. Suffer according to God's will. So what's the last thing? Do you then entrust your life, your soul, to the faithful Creator? Do you lean? Now, that's interesting language that Peter uses here, faithful Creator. That's not a common way of speaking about God. It's not untrue, but it places the emphasis differently. Peter refers to him as the Creator. Why call on him in the midst of your suffering as Creator? Well, you know what the creator language picture is, right? He's the supreme maker. He made it all. You know, everything that exists in the universe, this one's responsible for. And he's faithful, dependable, reliable. Why? Highlight, in the midst of our suffering, entrusting ourselves to the faithful creator. I think it's because in the midst of my suffering, in the midst of my trials, in the midst of my trouble, I end up with two questions. The first question is, can he help? Can he really help? Well, he's creator. He spoke and universes came into existence and he didn't break a sweat doing it. Can he help? Yes. Well, will he help? He's faithful, dependable, reliable. He is an ever-present help in time of need. So in the midst of the suffering, what should we do? We should entrust ourselves, fall fully on, depend wholly on the faithful creator. He is faithful, dependable. He's present help in time of need and certainly has all of the resources necessary to rescue us, to see us through, to sustain us and keep us. And give us grounds for rejoicing even in the midst of our sufferings that we don't understand fully. So abandon yourself to him. Suffering may be God's will. Some of you are going through suffering and you wonder. You're shocked. Things are not playing out nicely. And what you mean by nicely is the way I thought they should. But who made you the author of the story? Who made you the director of the show? Who put you in charge of how God's glory is going to be put on display? I just act that way. And as a result, when things don't go my way, I'm surprised, I'm shocked. This is not how I wrote the story. And then because it's not how I wrote the story, I'm not glad about it. I'm not glad living well in the midst of the suffering, so I'm not rejoicing. And I'm embarrassed because life is not playing out the way that I had planned it was supposed to go. And hence, I'm embarrassed and then I don't glorify God. I do not make much of him in the midst of it. And I stop trusting the faithful creator and I back up to find plans and programs and systems in order to get my life back on the track I think it's supposed to go on. Although Peter's advice might be counterintuitive, it's not delusional. It might not be the first way you think when you encounter various trials, but it is so real and true to life. If you're a follower of Jesus, there is nothing that comes into your life. There is nothing that comes into your life that does not come through the hands of the faithful creator. There is no suffering that you endure, that you go through, that isn't for the purpose of putting on display your ability to depend on him. There's no suffering, no trial, no sickness, no conflict, no difficulty wherein you could not rejoice because here is a chance to share in Jesus' life. There is no suffering, no trial, no tribulation, no difficulty, where in fact God could be glorified in your life. And if that were the case, then you would be living very differently in the midst of suffering, as counterintuitive as it might seem. This is not delusional thinking. This is, in fact, gospel reality. To be surprised, to not rejoice, to be ashamed, to not glorify God, to try and make it work on my own are indicators that I'm just not clear on what the gospel is about. I'm just not committed, given over to the life of Jesus in my life. And I think I have a better way to write the story where God's going to get glory. But if I stop being surprised and I actually rejoice, if I keep on rejoicing, not ashamed, but glorify God and continue to entrust myself, then I've understood something of what the grand storyteller is telling in this world. Charles Simeon, he's an old guy. I like lots of, not old currently. He's dead. What I mean by that is there are lots of things that come home to me when I read old dead guys. Charles Simeon lived in the, born in 1750, died 1836. Almost his entire life, he was pastor and teacher at Trinity Church in Cambridge. And it was a horrible, troubling life. I mean, when he first began to teach at Trinity College, nobody would associate with him. He was too evangelical for the faculty there. They would actually schedule their classes around his classes so that no student could attend his classes. He sought to teach faithfully the gospel, and even those in faculty at the school chastised him and dismissed him. He got appointed to be the rector of the church at the school. And when he first took that position, the people didn't want to hear him. They said, "We'd like to hear that guy. We don't want you to speak." In his little church, when he first began, it was a church not like this, where you could actually lock your pew. They had ushers who would come, and because you gave to the church, you'd have a particular pew that you sit in, and they would unlock your pew so you could sit there. And when Simeon first began his ministry there, they would lock the pews so that no one could sit there. And so Simeon would set up chairs in the aisle so that the people who wanted to hear a good message could sit in the aisle, and the deacons would come and throw all the chairs out of the church before he started to preach. It went on like that for 40 years. Trouble, both inside and outside the church. Suffering, both inside and outside. And towards the end of his life, he was talking with others about this idea of suffering. And I think that he captures, in his words, much of what Peter has been saying to me. This is what he says. "I am sorry when I hear a Christian say, 'These people insult me, therefore I'm going to insult them. They speak evil of me and they deride me and mock me. It is with better reason that I should do the same towards them.' My dear brother, I should say to such a man, 'You are quite in error.' When the early disciples were persecuted, it was to turn to a testimony for them. So it will be with you. Someone will mock you and trample you. A man will come and, as it were, slap you on your face. You rub your face and say, 'This is a strange thing. I don't like it.' Simeon says, 'Sir, never mind that you don't like it. Say, this is my opportunity. This could turn into a testimony of what I'm living for.'" He goes on to say, "When we revert to the subject of suffering for Christ's sake, Simeon said, 'My dear brethren, we must not mind suffering. When I am working my way through a hedge, if my head and shoulders are safely through the hedge, I can bear the pricking of my legs. Let us rejoice in the remembrance that our holy head has moved through all of his sufferings, and he has triumphed over death. So let us join him and follow faithfully. We shall soon be partakers of his victory. You are sharing in his life. He has made the way through the sufferings. And if you see that, then don't be surprised. Keep on rejoicing. Do not be ashamed. Glorify God. Entrust yourself to the one who judges righteously, as the head did, who's already been through the sufferings, and he is simply pulling us through to share in his life and goodness and glory. And as counterintuitive as that might seem, that's gospel life. That's the reality of the life we share with Jesus." Let me pray. I do confess, Jesus, that I am at times quite delusional. Wherever it came from, I have this idea that I should be writing this story. I have this thought that I must know what's going on, and I know what good would look like. And so I am surprised when the story plays out differently than I thought. When, in fact, there is suffering and trial and trouble. I'm shocked. But I long to abandon myself from depending on myself. I long to find freedom in absolving myself from the responsibility of making sense of the story. I long to be awakened to this idea. Oh my goodness, by grace and mercy and by your Spirit, you've brought me into life, and I get to share in your life, and that might well include suffering, and that would be fine with me if I saw that all of this and the sovereign hand of the Father, all of this was to grow me up, to share in your life. What could be a better story than that? May it thrill us and give us grounds for rejoicing. And in that, may you receive glory, Jesus, for you deserve all glory. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.